You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, also online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. She was tireless in writing and speaking out against racial injustice and discrimination. She was committed to doing something about the problems she saw. This afternoon, we'll take a look at the life of women's rights advocate, anti-lynching crusader, and journalist Ida B. Wells. Our guest is historian Mia Bay. She is the author of the new Wells biography, To Tell the Truth Freely. Wells was born to slave parents in Mississippi in 1862. She began her work against lynching and mob violence at the age of 30. Bay says it would remain her life's work, and with good reason. She says South and North, mob violence went wholly unchallenged. In a period of almost 50 years, beginning in the late 19th century and lasting well into the 20th century, more than 3,000 African Americans died at the hands of white mobs. Bay says Wells was able to cut through the myths about black rapists that white Southerners used to defend lynching. Wells, says Bay, argued that lynching had nothing to do with rape and everything to do with power. Questions and comments this afternoon are invited for our guest, Mia Bay. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Mia Bay, is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University and the associate director of Rutgers Center for Race and Ethnicity. Her book, To Tell the Truth Freely, is published by Hill and Wang. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Mia Bay, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Thanks to your descriptions of her, I see Ida B. Wells as a forceful and courageous person, a woman who seemed always to have a firm sense of purpose. Here at the outset, would you share with us the picture of her that you have drawn here and how you think of her?
One of the things I found really challenging in writing about her is to try to account for, you know, her sort of tireless energy and conviction when it came to doing the right thing. And I'm not sure I can fully account for it, but I do know that, she was literally born at the dawn of freedom. She was born during the Civil War. And her parents were very ambitious for their children. They died when she was still a teenager, but I think that she, took a lot from her parents, who were ex-slaves, in terms of valuing freedom and understanding that blacks had to work for their political rights. So I think that was part of one source of her determination.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about life back there in Mississippi at the time of emancipation and then shortly thereafter Reconstruction. Prior to emancipation, what were her parents' lives like, Jim and Lizzie Wells?
Jim Wells was actually the son of his owner, he was trained to be a skilled carpenter, and his wife also had skills as a seamstress, so they were relatively privileged among slaves, Jim Wells was not recognized by his father, and they were left with very ambivalent feelings about their relationship to the plantation that they lived on, because until he was freed, he was on his own father's plantation.
When and how did they see their emancipation?
Their emancipation came in the middle of the Civil War. They lived in Holly Springs, Mississippi, which was a town which was taken by the Union forces and then taken by the Confederate forces several different times. So they literally kind of lived out the emancipation as the war was fought in their area.
And what was the transition from slavery to freedom like for them?
Well, Wells would remember that both of her parents did very well in freedom because they were able people, as she put it. That was certainly true. Jim Wells had considerable success as a carpenter. The family was able to buy a house. Jim Wells became involved in politics. They sent all their children to school. So they did very well up until 1878, when there was a yellow fever epidemic in the Mississippi Valley, and both of her parents caught that fever and died.
Yeah. And what were their hopes for Reconstruction?
They hoped to have full political participation. Blacks did gain the vote in Tennessee, and Jim Wells was a member of a political organization. They found themselves, blacks who exercised their political rights found themselves very much contested in doing so. One of the memories of Wells has of her childhood is of her mother sort of pacing the floor when her father went out to attend these union political meetings. But they really believed in the power of the vote, and Wells would believe in it, too, and sort of fight to get it back, because it would later be taken away from blacks in the South.
Yeah, and despite Reconstruction, there was great vote fraud, and white Democrats tried their best to keep black people disenfranchised. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that, how that worked?
Yeah, there was a considerable violence. So the reason why Lizzie Wells would worry when her husband attended political meetings is that black political meetings were ambushed, people were driven away from the polls at gunpoint, people who were leaders were singled out. Jim Wells lost a job when he told his employer that he was going to vote. So there were considerable pressures put on blacks who participated in politics even before they began to actually move to disenfranchise blacks, which happened when the Democrats were able to return to power in the South.
Her parents, their deaths come at a time at which the promise of Reconstruction has ended by and large. And so we've got more than her parents' deaths here. We've got the death of Reconstruction. She's a young girl, really, young woman anyway, 16 years of age. How did this affect her, these events?
Very dramatically. In her autobiography, Wells actually remembers herself as 14 years old when her parents died rather than 16, and I think that shows how utterly at a loss she felt. She was the oldest of all the Wells children, which meant, and they had seven children, including Wells, which meant that she had to take responsibility for them. And initially, it seemed like the children might be split up among various friends of the family, but Ida decided that that was not going to work, that her parents would not have wanted that. So she actually sort of lengthened her skirts, dropped out of school, and became the breadwinner. She became a teacher at a rural school nearby.
Yeah. One of the things that you write early in To Tell the Truth Freely is that personally, this is from your book, personally galling for Wells was the absence of any record of the courage and convictions of her parents and the political and cultural dramas of her own childhood, all of which had combined to give Wells an enduring faith in the power of black people to educate themselves and govern their own destiny. Would you say these events would eventually lead her, set her on course to become a journalist and an advocate for racial justice?
Yes, she had a very clear sense of, you know, rights and entitlements, and that the government owed some sort of protection to blacks, which I think that partially came out of the kind of politics she imbibed in her youth. And you have to keep in mind that she literally comes of age as, you know, Reconstruction is dying, and the kind of segregation, high levels of segregation that would follow are taking shape. So she's very aware of what is being lost. And in fact, one thing that really gets her going as both an activist and a journalist is when she is thrown off a train because she's not supposed to sit in what was then called the ladies' car, which was increasingly reserved for white women and their male companions.
Yeah. Tell us more of this story of her challenge to the color line on the rail line she rode in Memphis, Tennessee.
She moved to Memphis to live with an aunt after several years of teaching in Mississippi, and during her first year in Memphis, she was still teaching at a rural school, so she had to kind of commute to work, take a two- or three-hour train ride to go. This was a time when sort of traveling by train was becoming increasingly common, whereas it hadn't before, and it was great for Wells, who had previously traveled to her schools by mule, but it was also a time when segregation was sort of being worked out on the trains. This was before the trains had white and colored signs, before the directions were clear about such matters. But nonetheless, it was often felt by conductors and railroad officials and people who rode the train that blacks should not be seated in the first-class car, which was then known as the ladies' car. It was trains at that time typically only had a locomotive and two cars, and the car right behind the locomotive was known as the smoker, and it was where men could smoke. It had, boards for seats, whereas the ladies' car was a real compartment with upholstered seats, no smoking. It was supposed to make women comfortable with traveling on the train. So, of course, Wells liked to travel in the ladies' car, but one day when she got on the ladies' car and sat down, the conductor came and told her that she had to leave. And she refused to go. She said she had paid for her ticket, and she didn't want to leave. And she didn't want to sit in the smoking car. And she ended up having a physical fight with the conductor. He had to summon two men to help him carry her off the train. And after that, she sued the railroad and wrote an article about that experience, which was the beginning of her journalistic career.
Yeah, yeah. And here's another sign of her tenacity as a young woman. This case lasted years.
Yeah, she continued to ride in the ladies' car even after the first case. While it was still going through the courts, and she actually got thrown off again and sued another time, and her case won in the local courts because, in fact, the car was designated the ladies' car, and the judge said, well, she was a respectable, well-dressed person who seemed like she, was a suitable presence in the ladies' car. The judge was a union man from the North, but when it went to the Supreme Court of Tennessee, they said that they said that the cars were the same and she should basically settle for whatever was offered to her, so she lost, which was very disheartening to her, but it was part of a trend. By 1896, you would have Plessy versus Ferguson, which would rule that segregating blacks and whites on trains and other conveyances was perfectly legal.
It seemed she never got discouraged, really. I mean, she, disappointments, yes, but she kept on going.
Yeah, I think she had moments of being discouraged, but she tended to just kind of shake them off and continue moving on. She wasn't a sort of very vocal Christian, but I think she had a deep religious faith, and she certainly was very familiar with the Bible, and she would often kind of look to the passages of the scriptures to kind of get the strength to go on.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Mia Bay. She's the author of the new biography of Ida B. Wells, To Tell the Truth Freely. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I am very interested in the conversation. Some years ago, I did read Ida B. Wells' autobiography, which I believe had been finished after her death by a granddaughter.
That's correct.
That's correct, Althea Duster. What I'm very interested in is the relationship that Ida B. Wells had with other prominent African-American figures at the time, in particular Booker T. Washington, which I know there's many stories about. But I guess I also wondered if she had, if you found that she had a lot of connections or many connections with other successful black women at the time, even black women of business and commerce, such as Madam C.J. Walker. And so if you could just comment on either the Booker T. stories or some of the relationships with women stories, I thank you, and I'll listen on to the radio.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I'd be happy to. Ida B. Wells' autobiography was actually finished by her daughter, Alfreda Duster. But let me just say, she initially admired Booker T. Washington. She liked the idea of black self-help, of people working for themselves. But as it became clear to her that he was not going to contest segregation or lynching, she began to be a little bit disgusted with him. And in fact, there was a lynching in Atlanta at the turn of the century, which Booker T. Washington initially refused to even respond to. And that was sort of the moment when Ida B. Wells washed her hands of him. She felt that someone who sort of billed himself as or was understood to be the great leader of black Americans needed to speak out against racial violence. She knew a lot of prominent women, black and white. She was influential in the women's club movement at the turn of the century. She was one of the founders of the National Association of Black Club Women. She did know Madam C.J. Walker and admired her, but she would not actually stay in the club women's movement that long because she had goals that were more political than their goals. They were often kind of focused on the home and domestic issues, and she didn't always see eye to eye with the club women. She was very, you know, she very much went her own way. She was a very determined person and kind of kept to her own agenda.
And also another figure that I think maybe you could talk about is her Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Mm-hmm. Again, she admired W.E.B. Du Bois, and when his Souls of Black Folk came out in 1903, she and her husband, Ferdinand Barnett, were very enthusiastic about it, and they were definitely on W.B. Du Bois' side of the controversy that emerged between Du Bois and Washington. They sided with Du Bois in thinking that the franchise was very important and that accommodationism was not the way to go. Over time, she would not work so closely with W.B. Du Bois. After she married and had children, she tended to stay in the Chicago area. And she was suspicious of W.E.B. Du Bois over time. She wasn't sure how much he supported her leadership.
What was her life like in Chicago?
Her life in Chicago was more settled than it had been. She was driven out of Memphis when she wrote about a lynching. So she spent several years touring, talking, giving speeches against lynching, and it wasn't until she married and moved to Chicago and married that she really settled down. And she would go on to have four children with Ferdinand Barnett, which would keep her relatively close to home, but it wouldn't diminish her activism in any way. She continued to protest lynchings. She organized a women's club there. She became an activist in all kinds of local affairs. She worked for the Republicans. She supported women voting when Illinois women got the chance to vote in some elections early on. So she remained an activist in Chicago, but sometimes more in the community there than nationally.
Tell us a little bit about her husband, Ferdinand. What a fascinating character he must have been.
He was a fascinating character, and just seemed perfectly suited to Ida B. Wells. She was a very pretty young woman who didn't marry until she was over 30, which those days was like over the hill. But he turned out to be perfect for her. She had had, you know, lots of flirtations and, you know, suitors in the past, and had always found that they kind of came up short in terms of their, you know, determination or intellect. And those two just hit it off, and he was very supportive of her career at a time when not all men would have been. She didn't like to house clean, so he hired a house cleaner. He hired a nurse to help her with her work. He was a lawyer. He had, who also was a newspaper owner for part of his career, and had been a teacher. So he had interests very similar to Wells, and they worked together on many things, fighting for justice for blacks in the in Chicago and Illinois.
And can you tell us a little bit about their relationship at the level of man and wife?
Yeah, I mean, there's a limit because actually not all of her papers survive, but you do get some stuff in both the autobiography and some of her daughter's recollections. They seem to have an unusually sort of egalitarian, companionable marriage. Ferdinand Barnett did all the cooking and would come home from work and make dinner while Ida B. Wells read the newspaper or looked after the children. Their house hosted all the sort of prominent blacks who came through Chicago, and they also, Ferdinand Barnett always kept a kind of open door to blacks who were in trouble, who would he would meet someone at the courthouse who needed legal advice or representation and just bring them home for dinner. So they had an unusual sort of activist household in which things were going on all the time. Yet they also had these four children, and Ida was also a dedicated mother. She fought to get kindergartens for her kids, and sort of dedicated herself to kind of taking care of them and seeing them through while also pursuing her own activism.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Mia Bay, excuse me, is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of To Tell the Truth, Freely, the Life of Ida B. Wells. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back to Memphis. She arrived there in 1881, and she was a school teacher. How did she make the move to journalism?
Well, she hadn't entirely finished her education herself, so she was only qualified to teach in the elementary grades, and she didn't really like it over time. She didn't feel like it was her calling. So once she wrote her first article on her lawsuits for a local Baptist paper, she continued to write, submitting articles all over the place, and she rapidly emerged as one of the leading female journalists of her era. Her work was reprinted in other newspapers, which was customary during that time, and she had a real knack for sort of writing very hard-hitting, interesting, lively pieces. So she actually earned the nickname Iola, Princess of the Press. Eventually, she invested in a paper of her own, The Free Speech, which she would be half owner of ultimately. And that was because it was otherwise very difficult to make a living in the newspaper business at that time. She didn't always get paid for her pieces, and when she did get paid, it wasn't very much. So once she invested in her newspaper, she was eventually able to make a transition over to being a full-time journalist. And she also kind of had to do it because she got in trouble with the school board for one of her newspaper pieces, which critiqued the behavior of some of its members.
Yeah. How did she, when she was in Memphis, particularly at the outset, she was helping to support family members, and she struggled to make a living. How was it she put the money together to invest in the Free Speech and Headlight?
With great difficulty. I mean, she did it after some of her two brothers were out of the house, and she had gotten herself into a better situation. But she was just always saving and scrimping, and I guess she didn't have to invest all that much to get her part ownership. So she just, it's actually really kind of hard to figure out how she did it, but just, I guess, through careful marshalling of her resources.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of what that paper was like?
Not entirely, in the sense that no copies of it have survived, entire copies of it, that we do have many of her articles that were reprinted elsewhere and pieces of it. But black newspapers of the day, of that day, they tended to be relatively brief. They contained a mixture of material from the editor and from outside sources. They didn't have, you know, they were kind of shoestring operations without a lot of journalistic staff. So I would imagine that Ida B. Wells really wrote most of it, which was one of the great things that she brought to the free speech and one of the ways that she was able to kind of invest in it, not just with money, but with her own personal time. And she sold it by traveling around. Journalists could get a press pass, and she would travel up and down the railroad lines, going down into Mississippi and traveling around the South, selling the paper. And the paper was popular among black audiences. She eventually actually had to start printing it on pink paper because news vendors were prone to giving blacks who bought it, who were sometimes illiterate, the wrong paper. They would just, they asked for free speech and they would give them whatever they had, the Police Gazette or something else. So Ida had to print it in such a way as it could be identified. And the reason why the people who bought it might not even know what it said was that people read the newspapers together there, like, a, you know, one person who could read would read the newspaper and everyone would listen. So there was a tremendous hunger for news and black perspectives on things at that time.
Yeah. So let's move up now a few years to the spring of 1892 and the incident that would launch her on her crusade against lynching and mob violence. It began, you report, with a game of marbles at a place just outside the city limits of Memphis known as The Curve. Tell us what happened and how it led Wells to begin her fight against mob violence.
Sure. The Curve was a predominantly black neighborhood, which on the border of a white neighborhood. So the game of marbles was between a group of black boys and a group of white boys. Who started to fight over who had won. And then a white man came out and whopped the victorious black player, at which point black men who were in the neighborhood and seeing it began to gather. And a sort of altercation began to take place, which eventually moved into a local black-owned grocery store called the People's Grocery. The People's Grocery was one of two grocery stores right in that area. The other was a much longer-established white grocery store, which actually had lost a lot of business to the People's Grocery. So as the disturbance swells, there's actually ultimately a shootout. And then a sort of a no-holds-barred race riot that just comes out of conflicts over this game of marbles. And the sheriff comes in, sort of rioting develops over the days, but there's an attack on blacks, a lot of it being led by the owner of this rival grocery store. And over the next few days, hundreds of blacks are arrested. Among them are the owners of the People's Grocery Store. And one night, these three men are taken out and shot. Now, Ida was away when this happened, and she knew one of the grocery store owners very well, Thomas Moss, who was a letter carrier as well as a part owner of the grocery store. And so she just comes home. She's been away, and she comes home to find blacks fleeing Memphis. Thomas Moss and these other two men who she also knew are dead,
And when she reads the white newspapers, they're kind of proud of themselves and talking about restraining order. So she's horrified. I mean, she realizes in a very personal way that lynching, this kind of vigilante justice, has nothing to do with rape. These men hadn't been accused of rape, and Ida really thought from the very start that their crime had been that they had been successful businessmen who competed with this other store owner.
Yeah.
And then contributed to the violence against him.
I think we should mention the other two men, Calvin McDowell and William Stewart. And then there was this fellow who owned the white grocery store that had a lot of black customers before the People's Grocery Store went into business. He, it seems, saw at least the initial fight as an opportunity. Do we know much more about his motivation, who he was, and do you think he had any inkling about where this could all lead?
I think he could. I mean, it was hardly the first lynching, some men in the store started to defend themselves, and once shots were exchanged, Memphis really went into chaos. People were going around talking about shooting black people, and he seems to have been important to these particular three men being chosen as the ones to be lynched, because there's no obvious, they had really no obvious connection. Thomas Moth was not even there during the initial altercation, and the other two men weren't especially culprits in any of it. But he seems to have upped the ante and organized the mob. So he may well have had some, I'm not sure he could have known exactly what would have happened, but he seemed to be prepared to create some violence.
Let's take another call now, a listener in Urbana. You're on the air with Mia Bay. Hi.
Hi, a very interesting topic. In my reading history and looking back at that time, lynching was like a sport for white society in the South. They would have... they would churn ice cream, and the kids would go to these lynchings, and I could certainly see how she could be anti that type of event. Are there any other details on the situation that took place back in 1892 made for her anger?
Yes. I think one of the things was that Memphis hadn't had any lynchings really since the sort of all-out violence of years immediately post-Civil War. So the Memphis black community prior to the lynching really was doing well, was flourishing, did not think that Memphis would be the kind of place where lynchings would be tolerated. So that was part of what made it such a shock, and it made it kind of... or have to kind of rethink what Memphis was about. Prior to the lynching, Ida B. Wells, sort of called herself a Southern girl and really had sort of committed herself to a life in Memphis. So it really just made her look at the place she lived with entirely new eyes. And it also made her look at the aspirations, her own aspirations and those of people around her new eyes. I mean, one of the things she emphasized about Thomas Moss was that this guy was a Sunday school teacher. He was a man who worked both as a letter carrier and at the grocery store. He was doing everything that blacks were supposed to do to gain respect in the New South. And at that the lynching made Ida question whether any of those things would work or were even worth doing. And after the lynching, she actually began to advocate that blacks migrate out of the South.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Well, only to the extent that I grew up in the South, and I found it amazing when I moved to Illinois, and many, many blacks were Republicans. And, you know, if you look at the Democratic Party, the Southern Democrats, who are now the most rightist Republicans, you know, it's kind of interesting that, and obviously Lincoln and the Republican Party, you know, we have him the champion for freeing the slaves, but it's just kind of ironic that you look at back in the South at that time. You know, Democrats were mostly whites, and today you won't find that in the South. I guarantee you that most of those Democrats, the Dixiecrats, are Republicans.
Yeah, the sort of race lines of party affiliation began to shift with the New
right.
Deal, and have, you know, done a complete flip flop pretty much in the years since. I mean,
Thank
black
you.
Republicans are relatively rare.
Yeah. And the Republican Party, I think, with Richard Nixon, launched the Southern Strategy.
Right. Yeah, so the Republican Party hasn't actually been working that hard for black voters, one could say.
Yeah. She advocated migration after these murders in 1892, even holding Africa in view as a possible destination. This was not a universal view. Why did she come to see migration as a solution?
Because she felt that any kind of black success wasn't actually safe in the South. I mean, you know, there was really nothing that her friends in Memphis could have done to avoid being sort of targeted, and perhaps they were targeted because they were successful. So she felt that, you know, it was basically too dangerous. And then beyond that, she also did believe that it was very important that blacks vote, and the North offered such opportunities. So that was one reason to move north. But I think it was above all realizing how much violence was actually part of Jim Crow. There was nothing kind of like unrelated to the general politics of the South. Violence was this kind of sort of steady part of it, which she felt made it too dangerous to stay there.
Yeah. In the book, you say that Wells argued that lynching had nothing to do with rape and everything to do with power.
Yes.
How did she reach that conclusion, and then how did she make that point?
She reached that conclusion in the weeks and months following the Memphis lynching. She researched lynchings and you know, began to count them up, and she found that two-thirds of the men who were lynched were not even accused of rape or any kind of sexual crime, and that oftentimes when they were accused of such a thing, it would turn out to be a consensual relationship that, you know, sort of illicit interracial relationship that had become public, and then black men would be lynched. And she found this out through researching into newspapers, asking around in towns where there had been lynching, and it surprised her because lynching was so often associated with rape. And what she realized when she realized the true facts behind it was that one of the ways in which white Southerners kind of shut down any challenge to lynching was by associating it with rape. If all the people who were lynched men who were lynched with rapists were rapists, nobody really wanted to defend them, not even in the black community. They thought it might be justified, and it sort of kept people from really paying attention to what was going on and understanding the extent to which lynchings were serving entirely different purposes of putting people in their place, challenging men who got too far, who in any way threatened their white employers or white business. So the way she dealt with it was kind of directly to talk about it, and one of the most important things she did that really did capture a lot of attention is when she had to leave the South after her first lynching editorial, she would tell the story of Memphis, and she would tell the story of how she became an exile from Memphis, and talk about how she herself was threatened with death or dismemberment if she continued to critique lynching. And as a woman, I think in many ways it was easier for her to kind of take apart the rape myth than it would have been for a man at the time. It was taboo to talk about sexual matters generally, but Wells managed to talk about them by incorporating her personal story of sort of learning about what lynching was really about into public speeches and pamphlets and things she wrote.
Yeah. How successful was she in bringing the nation's attention to this violence, and what's been her legacy in the struggle for civil rights, in particular in the second half of the 20th century?
Great questions. It took her a while, but she was ultimately quite successful in bringing the nation's attention to lynching. Her early speaking tours in the States tended to attract mostly black audiences. But then in 1893 and 1894, she went abroad. She had met all sorts of people who were sort of in old anti-slavery networks through her connection with Frederick Douglass, who became an admirer of her work after he read her first pamphlet. And some of these anti-slavery there are a lot of people in Quaker families who had supported the anti-slavery movement. They became concerned about lynching and invited Wells over to speak. And Wells was very popular in Britain. She gave hundreds of speeches, published interviews. Her pamphlet, Southern Horrors, was published there. And ultimately, after her second visit, the British organized their own anti-lynching league and began to investigate lynching in the southern states. And at this point, white Americans began to take notice of anti-lynching because they felt like they were being sort of monitored by the British. They resented it. There was a tremendous sort of outcry against it. But at the same time, it put lynching on the table as an issue. And by 1895, you even had some states considering anti-lynching laws and Southerners feeling some need to at least justify lynching, while Northerners became more critical of it. So she kind of put it on the table as a problem. Of course, that didn't mean that lynchings ended, but I think her influence on the black protest agenda lasted for a long time, because the NAACP, which she was also involved with during its early years, put anti-lynching very high on its agenda, and racial violence generally. And like Wells, NAACP members would investigate lynchings and kind of try to expose the real conflicts behind them and debunk the rape myths and combat the racial violence that way. So I think that she left a kind of enduring impression. She kind of set up a sort of one-man protest strategy of investigation and exposure and sort of challenges, which had an influence on later civil rights organizing.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, but I do want to talk with you just a bit about the words she took up as her life's motto that she took from abolitionist Wendell Phillips: eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And she was always talking about guarding against complacency.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it seems to me, that put her out, put her out of a lot of institutions, because she thought that institutions, once they reached a certain point, they became complacent. Do you think that is is that part of the reason that for a number of decades she was largely forgotten?
I think that's definitely a big part of the reason, because one of the ways in which people get remembered is through some sort of standing in an institution. Early leaders of the NAACP, such as Walter White, are kind of known for that and, celebrated by the organization itself. Whereas Wells didn't achieve that kind of standing in an institution. I also think that by the time you get to the early 20th century, in many ways, it's even harder for a woman to be recognized as a leader. Increasingly during this period, even within protest organizations, leaders would be men. They would be college educated. The progressive era reformers tended to be educated. And Wells didn't really fit in as a kind of leader in that context. She was also a mother, which sort of made her someone who didn't seem to be a leader. So I think that a lot of her accomplishments got kind of appropriated by other people. People would talk about, Wells was disturbed by the end of her life that people would talk about the anti-lynching movement without even mentioning her sometimes.
Yeah. Also, she could be very angry. And
true. That's the challenge with Ida B. Wells, is to try to figure out to what extent, her own kind of temper propelled her out of these organizations, and to what extent maybe her temper was justified, because it was very difficult to be a black woman reformer at that time.
It's tough to be an angry woman today, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, there we have to leave it. Mia Bay, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mia Bay is the author of To Tell the Truth, Really the Life of Ida B. Wells. The book is published by Hill and Wang. Our guest is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University and the associate director of Rutgers Center for Race and Ethnicity.